you can just get your mind together, then come on across to me. We'll hold hands and then we'll watch the sunrise from the bottom of the sea. But first, are you experienced? Or have you ever been experienced? Well, I have.
If you've never seen it, watch footage of Jimi Hendrix at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967. Then you'll understand why his band was called the Jimi Hendrix Experience. Their debut album, Are You Experienced, was an immediate success both critically and commercially. But it was Jimi's stagecraft, a revelation to mostly white Greenwich Village audiences, where he emerged as a star, that cemented the experience. This craft had been honed while touring the incredibly demanding Chitlin circuit with the likes of the Isley Brothers and Little Richard. Those artists knew that audiences didn't just want music, they wanted a show. They demanded an experience. Dan Gingis recognized a long time ago that all customers appreciate an experience, and today he teaches individuals, teams, and audiences around the world how to become the experience maker at their organization and elevate their brand to a customer-centric experience leader. This week on Next in Queue, Dan and I discuss the skills he learned from direct mail marketing, the tightrope that is influencer marketing and how to do it right, functions social media excel at for brands and functions to avoid, the value of complainers to brands, personalization mistakes brands make, and how to fix them, how ChatGPT will impact customer experience, voice of customer and actions of customer, and why customer experience transformation projects often fail. Let's get to it.
Welcome to Next in Queue, the podcast for contact center and customer experience professionals. Next in Queue is brought to you by Happy 2 Vision. Eliminate blind spots and see right through every conversation with Happy 2 Vision. Learn more at HAPPITU.com. Now, here's your host, Rob Dwyer.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining another episode of Next in Queue. Today, I am bringing you Dan Gingis. Dan, how are you?
I am great. I guess I am now in the front of the queue, which I'm so excited about, but really happy to be here and chat with you, Rob.
Fantastic. So before we get started, you're a man who probably doesn't need an introduction, but I'd like to know how you got into this space, this CX kind of marketing space. Is that what you dreamed of as a young boy?
You know, it's funny. In college, I had a double major in psychology and communications. And what that means to folks listening is I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do. But what I found out later was that if you add up psychology and communications, what you really get is marketing. So I was sort of born to be a marketer, but I didn't know it. I did start off in marketing, actually in direct mail, and worked my way up through all the digital channels, email, social, SEO, et cetera. And then I had the opportunity while I was at Discover Card to take over a customer experience role, a specifically digital experience. And I just fell in love. I found my passion. I was so excited that I could make seemingly little changes and have huge impacts on results, on customer satisfaction scores, all sorts of things. And so now I kind of joke with people with, you know, with all due respect to marketers, because I was one for 20 years, that if I never have to do another marketing campaign again, it'll be too soon, because I would much rather spend the energy on getting my customers to do the marketing for me.
Yeah, I love that. Seems like maybe that digital experience was a far cry from the direct mail campaign.
You know, direct mail taught me so much, though, because if you think about it, and I am, you know, of a certain age where I can say I actually worked in the pre-internet age. But direct mail is all about targeting and segmenting and finding exactly the right customer in the right place. I had a really fun job where I was marketing sports paraphernalia. And I'm from Chicago, and I had to learn pretty quickly. I mean, I know this growing up in Chicago, but I had to learn how to do it, that you cannot market White Sox gear to a Cubs fan or vice versa. They're not going to like you. So you have to get, we had to get down to the zip code level and all this stuff. And, you know, now when you take those skills and you apply them to, say, targeting on Facebook, it's not that different. The skills, I think the foundational skills are still there.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. So in your book, The Experience Maker, you talk a lot about companies who make mistakes and kind of how they rebounded from them. And you've got some specific examples, but I think a lot of us are familiar with a recent influencer marketing misstep that a certain beer company experienced. And I'm wondering, first of all, is there a broader lesson, or is that a very specific lesson for a specific company? So that's my first question.
Yeah, I mean, especially in today's society, especially in the United States that is so politically divided, it's going to be difficult to please everyone all the time. And it's okay if you have a set of beliefs at your organization that lean left or lean right. I mean, that's fine, right? There's nothing wrong with that. And if that's how you want to run your business, it's totally okay. You know, think of a company like Chick-fil-A, right? Mm-hmm. Tends to be known as a fair, let's say, I won't even say politically, but it is a Christian oriented company. It doesn't, you know, the restaurants close on Sunday, et cetera. It is still an unbelievably successful brand that appeals broadly to Christians and non-Christians, right? So I think they do a really nice job of adhering to their values while also not necessarily pushing it on people or not being unwelcoming to people who maybe are not similar. That, I think, is probably the path that I would suggest taking. Either that or do what I do, which is don't talk ever about anything political in social media. Just stay right down the middle. We don't talk about social media. We don't talk about religion. We don't talk about anything that is going to get people up in arms. And that is hard to do, though, in all seriousness, because today's consumer, especially younger consumers, they want companies to take a stand. And so you're being asked to take a stand, then you take a stand, and the people who don't agree with you are now upset with you. And it is definitely a tightrope. But it gets back to the customer experience person in me, gets back to know your customer. And I would say this advice would apply to almost every company, is understand that for almost every company, your customer base is diverse. You may not be trying to make that so, but you have people who are in your customer base who are all different races, all different ages, all different sexual orientations, all different every way you want to, you know, divide people up. Your customer base probably has a lot of those people in there. And so the question is, what are you going to do to make sure that as many people as possible feel welcome in your business? Because otherwise we're turning customers away, and that's a tough business plan.
Yeah. I think the other question that I have that relates to that is there a lesson to be learned about influencer marketing? And maybe we should take a step back and kind of talk about what influencer marketing is. I assume most of my audience knows that, but I don't know that for certain. So can you tell us a little bit about influencer marketing and then, you know, what your thoughts are on that strategy in general?
Yeah, and I'll preface it by saying I'm not an expert in influencer marketing, but having been a marketer, I've certainly been around it. And frankly, having been asked by certain brands to be an influencer, I've been around it. So essentially what influencer marketing is it's finding people that have some influence, usually in social media, usually in the form of a certain number of followers or a minimum number of followers. And if you're smart, a minimum amount of engagement, because it's not just about followers. It's whether the followers are engaging with you. And getting those influencers to talk about your brand in a hopefully very authentic way. Oftentimes there is money that exchanges hands. And I think that's where it gets a little bit difficult because you, and then as a consumer, it's sort of left to you to figure out how authentic is it really? You know, do they really love this moisturizer, or is it because the company's paying them a lot of money to say it? Hard to know sometimes. I think the best influencers, though, are able to create content that really feels very authentic and genuine. I will tell you that I don't ever partner with a company unless I believe in the product or service that they're selling, because what's the point of me, you know, going out and telling an audience that I love, I'm making this up, but you know, if I were a vegetarian, you know, that I love McDonald's, like that doesn't right. link up. It doesn't make sense. So I always try to focus on companies that I, you know, have a consumer oriented relationship with. But again, you know, this can go in lots of places, because you have micro influencers who are people you've never heard of, but who are doing a really good job on social media and have big followers and frankly know how to make Instagram reels like the best of them and can do all of the work to get your product out there. And then you have major celebrities that basically, you know, show up to a TV commercial shoot and get paid gobs of money to represent a brand, and sort of everything in between there.
Yeah. Very interesting. I'd like to stick with social media for a little bit, but I want to change up exactly what we're talking about with social media. And what I want to talk about is social customer care. So I think we've seen over the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, a rise in companies engaging in customer care through social channels, whether that's WhatsApp or Twitter or Facebook. And I'm wondering if, number one, how successful has that been? And number two, do you think that's going to continue to increase as a channel, or have we maybe hit a plateau or even peaked, and might it be going the other way?
Well, I love that you're asking me this, because as you probably know, my first book was called Winning at Social Customer Care. And this is where I fell in love with social media. I took over social media at Discover again. And I have to remember exactly the date, but if you go look on my Twitter profile at when I joined Twitter, it was the day after I took over social media at Discover. And I was like, man, I better figure this Twitter thing out. Luckily, for all those wondering, it was, you know, north of a dozen years ago. So it was a while ago. But I immediately, as a marketer, I never loved social as a marketing channel. And this might have been because early days social, what brands were doing were things like, hey, let's put our TV commercial onto Facebook. It's another place for people to see our commercials. And I think they realized really quickly that people don't want to watch your TV commercial anymore on Facebook than they did on television. And that really wasn't the way that it worked. The thing about social media is it has two words. It's not just media, it is social. What I found almost immediately was it was a spectacular channel for service and for customer engagement. Because if you think about it, when we were growing up, if you wanted to communicate with a brand, you did not have a whole lot of choices. I mean, no one in history has ever called up the call center to say, hey, I just want to tell you, I love your brand. You're doing a great job. When I was a kid, I do remember writing letters to back to a direct mail. I remember writing letters to brands, but we didn't have a mechanism. Then enter sort of the millennial generation that grows up with social media, and it is just automatic. They can talk to any brand they want at any time they want. And that's what I think got this care thing going in social. I will tell you today, I still find it to be the fastest, most convenient channel. I would way much rather talk to a brand via a social channel than have to call. But that said, you asked sort of where we're going. I think, to be honest, the answer to that question is going to depend a lot on where Twitter's going, because Twitter has been by far the biggest channel for customer care in the United States. Outside the United States, it tends to lean a little bit more towards Facebook. But Twitter has been the leader in this. Now, there are lots of people that are fleeing Twitter right now, and there are brands that are fleeing Twitter. And so that's going to shake things up, and I don't know how that's going to turn out. What I do know is that any channel that allows people to communicate with brands easily, private message is always great. So in any channel, the private message channels tend to be favored. I think that's going to continue because today's consumer wants it to be easy. They don't mind waiting for an answer if they can go about their day. You know, I'll just send a direct message to the brand and I'll come back later and see if they've responded versus I got to wait on hold or I'm sitting on a chat watching those three dots, you know, waiting for the agent to finish typing. That stuff is, has gotten annoying for people.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think it'll be interesting to see what happens long term with Twitter. It seems like a lot of people are reevaluating just based off of some of the new costs maybe that might be incurred in serving that channel that weren't there before. And, you know, some of the other brand reputation questions that are starting to crop up when it comes to Twitter.
Yep. Big changes are afoot. We'll see what happens.
They are. Did it ever concern you that, and we'll just use Twitter as the example here, that the sounding board mechanism on something like that in using social for customer care kind of exposed, the complainers, if you will, of a brand without necessarily driving the same kind of traffic for positivity? Was that a concern?
So it is a concern for a lot of companies, which is why I always tell people, don't be afraid of complaints. Complainers complain because they care. They want you to solve a problem for them so they can keep doing business with you. The ones you should be afraid of are the people that just leave your business and never tell you why. Those are way scarier because they're going to your competitor. You obviously did something to annoy them and you don't even know how to fix it for the next person. Mm-hmm. The problem, though, that I think where brands really do lose some sleep is when you cross over from a complainer to what is more of a troll. And while I do argue that we should respond to everyone, the one exception, the asterisk, is trolls. We can ignore them, we can delete, and we don't have to engage with them. But it has gotten more difficult to weed them out. And so I think that's been challenging. But time and time again, I've seen brands that will take brand detractors, people that are upset in some way, and not only solve the problem for them, but convert them into advocates. Because one of the things that has been proven time and again in many channels is that when people have a problem that is then successfully resolved, they're often more loyal than the customer that never had a problem in the first place. Think about this in the sense of the insurance industry. We all pay insurance, say, for our cars, and we pay every month diligently, and it's a lot of money. And the thing is we don't really know whether we've got a good auto insurance company or not until we're in an accident. And now it's the most critical thing in the entire universe to us. And if that auto insurance company is there for us and they cover the damage like they said they were, and it's easy and the process is quick and simple, we love this brand. We're never leaving this brand. Alternatively, if this is the moment we find out that we're not covered for this or we're not covered for that, or our deductible is actually higher than we thought and it's a long and arduous experience and we don't have our car and it all kind of stinks, now we don't like this brand anymore. And so I think that's sort of the thing we've got to be aware of, is that when people complain, usually they want you to solve a problem. And if you can solve the problem, you're going to end up with an happier customer. And then the benefit of social is other people get to watch you do this. They get to watch you do it really well. And that's what I loved at the three brands that I worked at, is when you get all of the positive people like basically supporting the brand because either the complainer is too negative or because they've watched the brand solve the problem in real time in the public space. And they're like, this is great. This is the kind of brand I want to be associated with.
Yeah. Couple of great lessons there. The first one, don't feed the trolls. And the second one, if you're going to do that on social customer care, solve the problems and you can reap the benefits from that. Now, if you don't solve the problem, that could be a whole separate bag of worms, I imagine.
Exactly. And one last thing towards that, what I always advise to the best of your ability, do not ask people to move to a different channel. So the joke I like to make, you know, we've all seen this where we tweet or we post something on Facebook and the answer from the brand is, will you please email us or go to this website or call us? And I always joke, you know, if you ever called a contact center and they answered the phone and they said, sorry, we can't talk to you. Would you please tweet at us instead? Right. Like that's the most ludicrous thing ever. And yet that's exactly what we're doing in social media. A lot of the times is we're pushing people to the channel of the company's choice instead of the channel of the customer's choice. And I urge you not to do that. Do the best that you can to answer in the channel. I get it. If you work for a regulated industry or you've got privacy concerns, you may have to move them to the direct message aspect of that same channel. That's fair, but don't push people out of social and onto the phone. They already know you have a phone number and they have chosen not to use it because they want to use social.
I want to be clear. Dan is not advocating call centers deflect by telling people to tweet at them instead. That is not a new deflection technique that Dan is here advocating.
That would be a fascinating study. I'm not sure that it would work, but you know, think about how ludicrous it is. And yet, why is the opposite not ludicrous? The opposite has been accepted at a lot of companies.
Yeah. You talked about earlier with the direct mail campaign and then how we target on channels like Facebook, for instance, and how you can get very granular to be personalized, right? So I make sure that I'm marketing my Cubs gear to Cubs fans and not to White Sox fans who are not going to be receptive to that message. But I wonder as consumers, as we get more, maybe I'm making an assumption that we will, but as we start to look at data privacy issues, do you think there comes a point where there is a backlash against too much personalization because we're saying, hey, how did you know that about?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I think that when you know your customer, one of the things you know about them is how much personalization they're willing to accept. Let me give you an example. I think you're going to respond well to this because you go by Rob, and my guess is that your legal name is Robert. Am I right?
That is right. And that's actually my middle name.
Oh, even better, even better. Yeah. My legal name is Daniel, but the only person that calls me Daniel is my mother and only when she's mad at me. So I don't want people calling me Daniel. Yet on all of my official documentation, my license, my passport, my birth certificate, all of it, it says Daniel. When I have to sign up for a credit card or start a bank account or whatever, it says Daniel. When I travel the airline, it has to say Daniel. So how do we communicate with somebody who doesn't want to be called that? Most of the time, what companies try to do to say that they're personalized is you log onto their website and it says, good morning, Daniel. And it's like, wow, they knew my name and that it was morning. Woo, now that's pretty personalized. What they don't know is that it's like nails on a chalkboard because I feel like my mother's yelling at me, right? Or she's mad at me. One bank recently, when I went to log in, asked me a really simple question. They said, what name would you like us to call you? Wow. So now guess what their website says? Good morning, Dan. It's not that hard, right? But it's a big difference. Now, I don't know what your first name is, but my guess is you've got the same problem where you log on to sites and they're calling you by your first name, but you've chosen your middle name. And this isn't that difficult. I'll give you another example. A couple of years ago, and I wrote a blog post about this, I opened up 30 apps on my phone on my birthday. Now, these were all apps that I knew had my birthday on file. These are airlines, hotels, social media channels, banks, credit card companies. They've all got our birthday, right? I wanted to know how many of them wished me a happy birthday. It turned out of 30 that 3 of them did. Wow. That's not good enough, right? That's not good enough. If you have that data in your CRM, why the heck aren't you using it? That's a slam dunk, easy thing to do for a customer. Wish them a happy birthday. There are some brands that are now wishing happy half birthdays just to be different because too many people wish you a happy birthday, right? But I always say, if you're not going to use the data, then don't collect it. And if you are going to collect it, then please use it. But back to your question about, you know, what do people want collected? I think that there is a fine line. You can always win by asking the customer, right? Because they will tell you. There are other places, though, where I think you can be personalized without being creepy. So think about when you go to the bank, and I haven't been to a drive-through in the bank in a long time, but, you know, back in the day, if they saw there was a dog in the car, you know, they would send through the pneumatic tubes, they'd send a dog cookie, right, along with your check or cash or whatever it is that you're doing. If you go to Starbucks today and you're in the drive-thru and they see that you have a dog, they offer you a pup cup, which is basically a little cup of whipped cream for your dog. It's brilliant. And it's very personalized because they don't offer it to everybody. They only offer it to people with dogs in the car. Is it creepy? No. You got the dog in the car. They've seen it, right? Now, I suppose if the next time you opened up the app, it said, you know, hey, how's Spot doing today? Okay, that might be a little creepy coming from Starbucks, right? But similarly, if you have customers that have kids, you know, I always say one of the fastest ways to someone's heart is through their kids or their pets. So if you know that about your customer, why not leverage that in a meaningful, genuine way?
Yeah, no, that's great advice. And I think we are all willing to give up a little bit of data as long as we recognize that there's value coming back our way from that. And that really is ultimately, as opposed to you're just taking my data and using it for things that I don't want or don't care about. If I care about it, I'm okay.
Think of it this way. I'll give you my data as long as you use it for my benefit.
Right.
If you're just using it for your benefit, then no thanks. Right. I don't want you to have my data.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and there are a lot of companies that are definitely doing that. They're just selling it off. But there are plenty of people that are willing to give, I for one, give Google all kinds of data, right? But I really like using features that are customizable, like maps. And that requires a certain trade-off. And I recognize that. I'm not saying Google always does everything in my best interest, because they're certainly wanting their advertisers to sell to me. Yeah. But I understand where the trade-off is. And I think when we don't understand that, that's when it becomes problematic.
Oh, and worse is when we don't understand it because it's hidden from us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, privacy policies, advertising policies, cookie policies, we see so many of them, we're just numb to them right now. Okay, accept all cookies, right? We don't really know what we're signing up for. And yeah. I do think that that process has to get better. One of the things that I suggest, because one of the parts of my methodology in my book is being witty. And that means kind of having fun with your language, being clever anytime that it is that you're communicating. So even on something like a privacy policy, if you go to the privacy policy on my website, dangingus.com, you're going to see that I've instilled some humor in it. It's meant to be a kind of a fun read when you're like, but a privacy policy, that can't be fun. Of course it can. You just have to take a little bit more effort and make it into something that people want to read instead of something that they're going to automatically bypass.
Yeah. And something that was only lawyers care about reading, right?
Exactly. I'll tell you, I've done workshops with rooms full of lawyers, and I've talked about this concept of being witty. And it's really funny when you give them permission to be creative, all of a sudden these amazing ideas come out. It's just that the nature of their jobs does not allow a whole lot of creativity. And that's why I always suggest, you know, I mean, I was a marketer for 20 years. I worked with tons of corporate lawyers, and the best ones I had established a relationship with, there was trust and there was an understanding of sort of the give and take of marketing, you know, what we want to say versus what we're allowed to say. There's a give and take there. And if you mm-hmm. do it right, you can still have some fun. When I was at Discover, I think there was some regulation that came down where we had to digitize our card member agreement. Now, this is a document that you get whenever you sign up for a credit card that I guarantee you throw into the recycling bin. Digitizing it gave us an opportunity, though. And so we decided to make it interactive. We had, I think it was probably the youngest person in the company, like fresh out of college. We said, read this and highlight all the words you don't understand. And then all of those words, we added hyperlinks and had definitions. And what was fascinating is suddenly we had people coming to visit the card member agreement and actually engaging with it, because we just took the time to explain it to them versus putting it in all this language that only bankers and credit card companies understand.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. Okay, let's talk about the elephant in the room. I feel like it's the elephant in the year, not just the room, and that is generative AI. Lots of different solutions out there. Certainly ChatGPT has kind of grabbed the imagination of at least the online world. I'm curious, from your perspective, how can companies, or should companies, be leveraging this technology to make better experiences for their customers?
Well, I actually asked ChatGPT a similar question because I wanted to know what it was going to say. And it was actually pretty smart about it. It basically said, you know, as a language processing system, I'm not going to directly impact customer experience, but I can help to improve it in various ways. And I think that's a fair answer. You know, just like any new technology, you have these early first adopters that believe that the world is going to change and they need to be the first ones there. And that the change that we're going to see is so undeniably huge that we just have to be there to make it happen. An example would be when we first started seeing chatbots, right? The first responders were like, great, we don't need a customer service team anymore. Fire everybody. We'll just have the computers do it. Well, that didn't work out really well. And so similarly with ChatGPT, it's not taking over the world. It's not going to cause all of these roles to disappear. The smart companies, the smart content creators, the smart consumers are using it to supplement. So because the problem is right now in the early versions, the accuracy just isn't up to par. If you want creativity, if you wanted to write a sonnet in the style of LeBron James talking about Star Wars, it'll do that and it'll be really impressive. Okay. But if you are looking for, you know, the top 10 companies in terms of, I don't know, volume of car wash business or something like that, it's not going to find it for you, and or it's going to give you an answer that isn't entirely accurate. I actually did an experiment with my brother, who used to be a journalist, and we put his name into it, and it had all of this erroneous information. And here he's a guy that has had, you know, thousands of articles in the public sphere, and it wouldn't be that hard to figure out these facts about him, and it was wrong. And even when we told it was wrong, it corrected it wrong, right?
Doubled down.
So we cannot just assume that this is the be all and end all and it's going to solve all problems. That said, I have found it extremely helpful for generating ideas, concepts, the beginnings of a blog post that I then fill in some, you know, some more elements to, creativity, as I mentioned, finding some, you know, like I in my newsletter for a while, at the end of every issue, I had a joke about customer experience. And so I was getting some of them from ChatGPT, and they weren't bad. They were kind of funny. Why did the customer cross the road? To get to the better customer service on the other side, you know? Like, it was actually kind of humorous. And so there is that sort of element. As the last thing I'll say on this is, we are still very, very early days. So if you think this is big and impactful now, it is going to only get better. And as it gets better in terms of accuracy and safety and security and all that sort of stuff, I think it'll have a much more meaningful impact than it even does now.
I am going to reach out to LeBron James and see if I can get him to write a book of sonnets about Star Wars as soon as this episode is over, because I want that book, Sonnets About Star Wars by LeBron James.
That's we might be onto something here.
That's what I want. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about voice of customer. We've talked about social, and I think most people think about voice of customer and they think surveys. Are we sometimes missing getting all of the data that is out there in social media as part of voice of customer? Are companies doing that really well? What have you seen that really works to understand what customers really think about your company?
So I'm sure you've heard the expression of a 360 view of the customer, right? And this is easier said than done. But the reality is, if you're only looking for VOC in one place, it's probably not enough. None of them by themselves are going to give you the full picture. Even social, right? Because you're by definition excluding people who aren't on social media or who don't post on social media. And that is going to be a big portion of your population. So I'm a big fan of taking VOC from multiple places, as many as we can. And there is plenty of software out there that will not only collect it, but will analyze it for you. And by the way, this is something where ChatGPT can be very effective, is taking huge mounds of data and making some sense of it. So whether we're talking about transcriptions from customer service calls, or we're talking about chat sessions or emails that come in, or social media posts and engagements, that all can be looked at. But I'm also a fan of looking at, besides from VOC, what I like to call AOC. And this is with apologies to the Congresswoman from New York. I am not talking about her. I'm talking about actions of the customer. Because sometimes what customers say and what they do don't align. So we need to pay attention to what it is they're doing as well. And so what actions of the customer might look like would be the customer journey on your website. Where do they come in? Where do they click? Where do they go? Where are the various places that they go? Where do they get stuck? If you have a search bar on your website, what do people search for? Hint, it means they can't find it. Right. Aha. Maybe we need to bring it forward, or we need to make it in a more apparent place. These are all actions of the customer. And what's great about it is you don't have to talk to any customers to get it. You just have to pay attention to what it is that they're doing. If you're an e-commerce company, buying habits. If you're a credit card company, spend habits month over month. We've got all of this data, and reviewing it will give you a really good sense of where the customer's at, especially if we then meld the AOC and the VOC together.
Yeah, I love that. In particular, because I think specifically surveys. Number one, I think a lot of customers are in survey fatigue. They just don't, like, even now, like every time, and I avoid them like the plague, but I must admit that I shop at Walmart occasionally. And every time you go through their self-service checkout, they present you with a 5-star survey. Like, I don't want to rate you based on this interaction. I just really don't. And that's more and more, like everything that we do, we're being prompted with surveys. And I'm not entirely convinced that today that they're super reliable as far as what people are responding, or the fact that your sample size just might not be very good, because people like me just go, I don't want to rate it. So understanding that the behaviors are absolutely a truth, that tells you what's happening with your customer in a lot of ways, regardless of what they're willing to give up to you.
For sure. I mean, one of the challenges of surveys is it's a self-selected audience. Unless we can force people to take the survey, it's going to be self-selected. A couple things on this. Number one, I've learned time and time again that if you want a better completion rate, you need to ask fewer questions. So the longer it is, the better chance people will drop off in the middle of it. So we got to get to the point faster. The other thing is, I think oftentimes surveys, again, it's like when we're talking about the exchanging data, right? Are you going to use my data for me, or are you going to use the data for you? I think surveys are very similar. Even the question about, would you recommend us to a friend, which is the source of the NPS score, is really about the company. It's not about the customer. Mm-hmm. Right? A better question would be, how happy did we make you today? Or how easy was it to do business with us today? Now that's about the customer. Either way, though, some of the responses that we get on a survey, let's take NPS, for example. I mean, it's probably the, this is Net Promoter Score for those that don't know, is the most well-known, most used customer experience score, I guess. And one of the challenges with it is that it tells you how you're doing at a moment in time. It does not tell you why, and it doesn't tell you what's going to happen next or even what's happened previously. And so I've been in so many companies where they meticulously track the NPS score. And if it goes up, everybody's high-fiving, clinking glasses, cheering, shooting off fireworks. And if it goes down, everybody's blaming the weather or COVID or climate change or something else because they have no idea why it went up or down.
Right.
And so that's the challenge, right? And this is also, I would say, where this leads me to is we're talking about voice of the customer and we're talking about surveys. It isn't just about the numbers. It isn't just a 1 to 5 scale. You really have to get some of that qualitative meat in there, right? Mm-hmm. So that you hear why do people think this? What's really on your mind? Why do you, Rob, not want to mark us 1 to 5 stars right now? What's happening? Are we, and likely what it is I just want to get out of the store. This is not the right time to ask me because I'm in a hurry. Okay, that is great feedback. Maybe we need to ask him later on email or via text, and maybe you would be more responsive to that at that moment. But if we never get that meat, then all we see is some guy that didn't fill out the survey, and therefore we have no data on him whatsoever.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's great insight. Speaking of voice of the customer, I've read multiple places where, you know, customer experience, customer satisfaction is, if not at all time lows, in a bad place lately. At the same time, we're spending all kinds of money on different solutions that are supposed to improve customer experience. We're bringing in maybe experts into our company to help us with that. I guess my question is, are we at this low point because customer experience is a moving target, or have we as customers just gotten to a point where we're really, really, really difficult to make happy anymore?
I think it's a little bit of both. And what I would add on to it, and this is something that I try to teach audiences in my keynotes and workshops, and really, if I could spread this gospel to as many companies as I can, I'd love to, which is that customer experience does not have to be a multi-year, multi-million dollar transformational project. Because if it is, especially in a big company, then it's being prioritized against other multi-year, multi-million dollar transformational projects, and it's going to lose. And the reason it's going to lose is because, you know, we haven't updated our computer system in 3 years, or it's time to redesign our website, or if we don't do this, the lights are going to turn off. There's always going to be a reason why not to invest. I look at customer experience instead as a series of little things. Now, it is an endless series, so you have to enjoy the journey because there is no destination. Right? Because to your point, customer expectations are constantly changing. It is evolving. But if we look at customer experience as a series of little things, it's so much more approachable. And anyone in the company can do it, even if their job description doesn't have anything about customer experience. If you're in the finance department, you make decisions every day that impact customers. Even if you never touch a customer, if you never talk to a customer, you are making decisions that impact them. So your job is customer experience. And when we also look at things as being as little things, you know, all the examples that I share in the book or in a keynote, the filters that I've put them through are they have to be simple, practical, and inexpensive. And the reason I do that is I want people to look at them and say, why aren't we doing this at our company? This is like so obvious. Yeah, but you're not doing it at your company, and you could be doing it at your company. So I think that if we can boil CX down to more of the simple things or the little things, it empowers all of our employees to be more customer-centric. And that's how you start to build this within the culture versus looking at it as a project. If it's a project, first of all, it has a beginning and an end. Second of all, it has a huge hot price tag, and neither of those are going to get it done.
I love that. And I think that is the perfect place for us to wrap up, because it's such great advice for really any company out there, is to just understand that it's little things, and it's a continuous effort, and it needs to be part of the culture. That is fantastic. Dan, thanks so much for joining the show. I really appreciate your time today.
My pleasure, Rob. It has been a ton of fun, and thanks for having me on.
Next in Queue is brought to you by Happy 2 and is produced by me, Rob Dwyer. If you enjoy this podcast, please, by all means, subscribe and or rate this podcast in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. But more importantly, please tell just one person about this podcast. Word of mouth is the best way for people to discover new content. As always, thanks for listening.